We are rolling. Let's make sure that. Right. Okay. So, episode 2 of the Tin Men podcast. And I am with River Hawkins, the founder and CEO of Human, an amazing charity. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about River. How did we end up sitting here?
Thanks, George, the founder of the Tin Men. We are sitting here because we came across each other on Instagram and aligned a lot with our content and what you were doing and what you were creating, and I found your content really compelling. And I actually can't remember who reached out. I reached out to you, didn't I?
I remember exactly when it was. It clearly means a lot more to me than it does to you. I remember I put a post up saying there are 3,600 refuge beds for women in the UK and 20 for men, which is 0.8%. I did the maths. And you shared every single slide.
Yeah.
I was walking home from work and I was like, Human has shared your post. Human has shared your post. Human has shared your post. I was like, who is this guy? And
oh, wait, you didn't know who we were. Thanks.
Well, no. I did know.
I'm
but
joking.
I was just like, who is this guy who just shared every single slide? And I appreciated it. And honestly, I'm not just saying it. That really got me going. At that point, I was in the hundreds of followers. Maybe like less than 500 followers. And this isn't about me, but it's grown a lot since then. And thank you. So thank you, River.
Absolutely, it was my pleasure. And I share content that I feel will resonate with the community. It really resonated with me, and I felt like it would resonate with the community. And I think your content is compelling, and it just got better and better. And you're doing brilliantly, and I love your work.
Thank you. It's a very difficult tightrope to walk, because it's a very sensitive matter. They're talking about the issues that men face. I remember telling my sister about Human. I think Human as a charities especially, are always old and drab and washed out and boring, but Human's like these big splashes of orange and it's exciting. I remember showing my sister it and I was like, check this out. This is a space for men to talk, non-clinical, anonymous, judgment-free. And her immediate reaction was, why does it have to be men? Why does it have to be men? Like, what is it that's so different about men that they need Human?
Well, I'll answer the first part of the statement. It's the question about creating Human. I wanted it to be appealing so that men felt like they wanted to access it. And that's what I felt was missing. And there was a big gap for that. So I'm glad you picked up on that. And yeah, the orange in terms of the color was also decided as it's striking, but also gender neutral. And coincidentally, one of my favorite colors as well. Why men? Because obviously it's very well known, and both our communities will know, in terms of the suicide rates of men versus women. Currently now 76% of all UK suicides are male. And the way that we're conditioned from a very young age to not open up and not ask for help, and even when we are asking for help, it's not accessed or not as accessible for us. And I know that you've posted about saying that men do ask for help, but there's still this crisis for men and mental health. So, and there is support out there for women, and I feel like there is lacking support in terms of men being able to increase their emotional intelligence, emotional education, and vulnerability and empathy. That's why I created Human. And with women and female friendship groups, there is more talking, there is more opening up. And also when men get older, there's studies that I've read around how women will maintain their friendships as they grow older and have their family and children, whereas with men, they dwindle. Those relationships and friendships dwindle and they aren't maintained. So yeah, the older they're getting, the less friendships they're having, or the more friendships they're losing. So then equals to less social nutrition, more isolation,
I think that's it that sort of echoes a lot of what Erin said in the first podcast, because she obviously set up the first refuge in the world for women. And I was just like, why is there not been a movement for men? Like, in terms of domestic abuse, I mean, they experience it in significant numbers too, but there's no sort of concerted effort for men to speak up as women have. And she was just like, women start campaigns, women get together, women speak up, whereas men don't. Men are sort of more isolated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I couldn't really find something, as I said, just that felt appealing, that felt more like something that you wanted to be a part of rather than something that you felt like you had to be broken or a number or signposted to be part of. I really wanted to make it feel like a movement to change this narrative of that we stay in isolation, that we're lone ships. Yeah. We're not, and we're all human beings, and obviously the name human, no pun intended, but we all need that connection, that human social nutrition.
I one of the posts I wrote was all about lockdown and the pandemic, and people always ask me, what is it like to be a man? And I'm like, what we're going through now is so similar to my personal experience of being a man, like the having to cross the road when you walk past someone, keeping your distance, like even the fact that you're masking your emotions quite literally. I was like, this is what it feels like to be a man, to feel separate, to be little of
that post that you were just talking about. Do you remember me messaging you about it, obsessing about it? I was saying, oh my God, this is one of the best posts I've seen. And it was so accurate in terms of what we're experiencing in that first lockdown and everyone commenting on that and expressing it and struggling. And then you, that post that you wrote and the crossing the street, I remember it so vividly. It was still, I think, one of the best posts I've seen.
Thank you. The feeling of feeling separate, or the way people look at you, the way people look at you during a pandemic when you pick up a loaf of bread and someone sort of steps back, that's in a more extreme way what it feels like to be a man, and just to feel unincluded in society and to feel sort of people afraid of you, and just that feeling of coldness in general, is that's what it's like to be a man, I think.
So much admiration of that post that I actually want to get it up on my phone and read some of it.
Should we read it?
Yeah, should we pause?
We will still roll.
To give context for people who haven't seen it already.
I mean, this is not a plug and it's not about me, but somehow it has become about me.
So here we go. Here's the post from the Tin Men we were just talking about. And the caption reads, are we living in a man's world? A man's world. They say that before you write, you need to get into the mindset of the story you're telling. Well, my story this time is men, and as of right now, I am well and truly in the right mindset to write about them. You see, this is not a usual weekday, as just over 24 hours ago, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson locked England down. The second wave of COVID-19 is sweeping across the world, and hard decisions have been made. We as a nation, all 56 million of us, are now trapped, enclosed in thick cold walls of brick and glass, peering quietly outwards to a dark winter ahead. Into a new world of isolation, of being switched on and always kept at a distance. Attitudes in this hardened place have now changed, turning to that of fear, of anger and coldness. But I know this feeling already. It's the mindset I was looking for, the mindset of men. Now we all cross the street to avoid others. Now we all know how it feels to be feared. To live in a place where people don't look at you quite right, where physical intimacy and human touch are forgotten, and where our emotions, at least to others, are masked. This is a life I already know quite well, a feeling I've felt before. This dull sense of coldness, of distance and exclusion. A world not of kindness and love, but of survival. Of loneliness, not affection. Of distance, not intimacy. And of fear, not friendship. So look around. Maybe it is a man's world. I love that so much, and that boom, that last line. So maybe it is a man's world, and it made me think of the song.
So what do you?
This is a man's world.
Yeah, exactly.
But it would be nothing without a woman or a girl.
I mean, no truer words have ever been spoken. What do you think it is like to be a man?
It has changed. Growing up, I felt, what I explained before, a lack of being able to say if I was struggling, and to be completely honest, a need to fight and physically. And that's how I proved myself. And that's what it was like to be a man for me, that I would fight to prove myself, or if I was in pain or struggling or had to deal with an issue, the answer was fight or numb. And for me, that only led one way, which was down. And I feel like our options are so limited in terms of how we deal with issues, problems, pain, and that the only acceptable emotion is anger. And that's how it really felt for me being a man growing up, until I then, which led me to reach breaking point, until I then luckily came out of that, got better, saw the issue and saw how wrong it was in the way that we're conditioned, and then felt I felt a need to set this up, to change that narrative, and to change the narrative from crisis response to prevention.
There's clearly a lot of you as River inside of Human the Charity. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what parts of you are in the charity and how you've sort of brought the two together, and more importantly, why? What has led your personal story to creating this charity?
My journey was that, which I've touched on, was that the way I was conditioned of what it meant to be a man was to not ask for help and to deal with everything myself, and the unacceptable emotion being anger to deal with pain or challenges, which is the opposite of healthy. and what happened was I was rolling on this emotional rock bottom for probably about 3 or 4 months before I finally went, okay, I can't keep trying to deal with this myself. So I went to the doctor, because, you know, when you're struggling with something physically, it's like, go to the doctor. So I thought, okay, well, perhaps I go to the doctor about this. And the approach that was taken was straight away, within 5 minutes, prescribing a medication. And for me, I felt like I had been trying to deal with it for so long myself that this quick response of medication for me didn't feel right. And I say that each their own, everyone is different, and I'm not giving an opinion or advice on medication, but for me, it didn't feel right. And I threw it away after 3 days, and I went back to the doctor and I said, I want to try everything else before I resort to that. Mm. And if other things don't work, then fine. But I don't want that to be the first port of call. So then I was put on a wait list for talking therapy through the NHS. And during that wait time, obviously I'm declining more.
How long were you on the wait list for?
10 weeks. It was just over, it was about 2.5 months. And then it was 6 sessions. I was allocated. And by the 5th session of this, I said, this is starting to help, but what happens now? Because we finish next week and I feel like we're just scratching the surface.
You fuck off, basically.
Yeah. And that was the response I got, that we can only offer you more sessions if you're suicidal. And that was kind of like the trigger or the turning point for me that started Human, because I felt that approach was so wrong, that we get you to a point and then leave you to fend for yourself. And with our health, and especially with our mental health, it's not something we graduate from. It's not university. Mm. And especially 6 weeks. I mean, so in a weird way, that gave me a determination to get better, because I felt that there wasn't something that provided that would change this narrative and provide something preventative rather than crisis response. Because, you know, when someone is suicidal, that can be too late. And we can, as we know with the statistics. And the other thing is the way, in terms of the fact that men are known to be able to hide things and cover things up and not say what's really going on, because we've been conditioned to deal with it by ourselves, and we're so good at pretending everything is fine when actually it's not. Someone could be suicidal and not revealing that after 5 sessions of 40 minutes talking therapy.
That's something I was talking about today on my with men, both sexes, but men especially. You have to ask twice, like, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. And then you get the pre-rehearsed, oh yeah, I'm fine. And then you're like, but how are you really?
How are you really? The real how are you, right?
And then you get a more telling answer, I find.
Well, exactly. And that's what I mean by the fact that you can either be in, men could either be in denial about it or really just hiding it. So if you're saying we only give you more sessions if you're suicidal, I could have been suicidal. Someone else in my position would have been suicidal and could be saying, no, I'm not. Because they don't want to reel at that point.
Yeah.
And someone described it like taking all these boxes out of the attic, throwing them all out, unpacking it all, and then being like, all right, gotta go. Do you want to arrange all yeah. that and put it all back up yeah. there yourself?
Yeah.
When it's a two-person job.
You just said it then, like men not wanting to talk. I've also heard a different approach to that, and that someone said, men don't talk about their problems because the world doesn't give a shit about men. And what do you think about that?
I think that when I said, if I said men don't want to talk, I would say it's through the societal conditioning. I think as human beings we do, and we need that to not only kind of thrive, but fundamentally to survive. Mm. And I don't think they don't want to talk. It's just we've been taught that we shouldn't.
Right.
So I think it's like the compliance of, okay, well, this is how I'm supposed to be, so I shouldn't, even though it feels bad not to.
Right.
And it feels really painful and hard and strange to be pushing this in, and this is why it comes out in other ways, in ways that are very destructive.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier how men only really express themselves through anger. But anger is a secondary emotion. It's always a secondary emotion to something else. So what is the primary emotion that's causing
behind this? Anger I always feel is fear.
Fear of what?
Fear of whatever it is, like whatever you're going through. It could be fear of rejection, fear of abandonment, fear of not being good enough, fear of not being, yeah. It's just, I think fear is behind anger to me.
And this takes me into those two words that are always written in full capital letters. Toxic masculinity. I always do a voice when I say it. Toxic masculinity.
Toxic masculinity.
Yeah. A divisive term that's found its way into sort of the gender debate.
And a term that I feel drives us away from equality, and a term that we as human don't use, which, you know.
And for me, it diverts attention away from the actual problem. And yeah. They are the toxic attitudes toward masculinity.
Exactly.
So yeah. I'm the next guest on the podcast is someone called Susie, and she's a researcher looking into sort of male suicide. And she told me about a story of her on a train not long ago. And she was on the train watching this guy, and he'd got through like a 4-pack of sort of strong cider by 10 a.m. And he was drunk in the middle of in the morning on a weekday. And he basically, she saw him like sexually harass a young woman. I think he must have said something to her, and everyone in the carriage sort of made sure she was okay, and you know, gave him the sort of the evil, quite rightly so. But no one dared ask what sort of man drinks that much alcohol in the morning. What must someone go through for them to become that way? And that's what's really toxic.
Definitely. And you're not excusing what he did in his behavior at all.
No.
To be clear, because I know you're not. Like, but it's about, I think what you're saying is about
understanding
why people do the things they do, and not making excuses for it, but actually so that we can address it and prevent it from happening again,
right,
and actually address the root cause rather than putting a rug or a plaster over it.
Right. I mean, there's a difference between understanding and then justifying. There is no justifying for sexual harassment in any set of circumstances.
And I didn't think you were. I think it's just always important to like clarify when we're talking about examples and things. But going on to it, on the term of toxic masculinity, I think Mark Green, who I've spoken about before, and I think he's brilliant. He's a writer who writes a lot on masculinity, and he has Remaking Manhood, The Little Me Too book. I'm remembering these titles off the top of my head. But he's brilliant if you want to look more into him, Mark Green. And I just want to say what he speaks about in terms of toxic masculinity. So he says how a term like toxic masculinity, even if we sense some truth in it, doesn't invite us to distinguish between ourselves as individuals and the culture we are caught up in.
Mm.
Masculinity is not toxic. Our culture's narrow, conformist, violent, bullying, man box version of it is.
I just don't get how people don't understand that. That is just so profoundly true.
Yeah.
We always look at the drunk man on the train, never, why is he drinking this much alcohol right now? Like, what has he been through? And often, if you look at the men in prison, for example, an overwhelming number of them have experienced childhood abuse, trauma, have alcohol problems, sexual abuse, have brain injuries. I remember reading a really good report recently about 97% of the most bullied boys in school, 97% had violent fantasies. And people will look at violent fantasies and be like, toxic. But the reason why these boys are having violent fantasies is because they were preparing themselves for violence to come. That was their way of their brain preparing themselves for more violence, because that's all they've...
Survival.
Survival. And that's, it's almost like a coping mechanism. It is a coping mechanism. Yeah, and no one asks why, what has a boy or a man been through to make them toxic? And people are so reluctant to ask.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's annoying, to put it mildly.
And you spoke about abuse, and I mentioned sexual abuse, and that I would need to double check the exact stat on it, but it's something like 90, I think it's like 97,
yeah,
96% of all of male sexual abuse cases go unreported. Mm. So 4%,
yeah,
are reported of the actual ones that, yeah, take place. Which leads me on to, and we've spoken about this, is the legislation of rape in the UK, which, right, has been changed by in the US, but it is legally impossible for a woman to rape a man under the legislation of rape in the UK, right, because a man, you have to have a penis in order to commit rape.
People don't believe that, but you just have to Google sexual offences.
I'm actually going to get the legislation.
It's in the world where we are quite rightly obsessed with gender neutral language. We're changing policeman to police officer, which is fantastic. No one wants to change the wording of the Sexual Offences Act, which is exactly as you said.
It's impossible for a woman to be convicted of rape because she would have to have a penis, yeah, in order to do so.
Yeah, and the only way a man could be raped is, of course, by another man.
So another man.
When everyone says, you know, 10% of rape victims are men, they're the men that are raped by other men.
So then it's the assumption that it is done by men. The Sexual Offences Act 2003. Rape, one, a person, A, commits an offence if, A, he intentionally penetrates the vagina, anus, or mouth of another person, B, with his penis. And then option B is that B does not consent to the penetration. And then C, A does not reasonably believe that B consents. So the rest is not relevant to what we're talking about. But point one is a person commits an offense if he. So it's not a person,
yeah,
because you're saying he and he has to have a penis. So it's not a person. It should say a man, really. And that's probably how they get away with the legislation, by calling it a person when they're referring to a man.
This is easily available. This is on the government's own website. This is that's the literal
legislation.gov.uk.
That's not just that. That's the actual legislation. That's the law. That is the law.
That's the law.
And then the academic definitions of rape are based on the legal ones. So therefore, yeah, it creates, it's like saying 95% of people getting kicked in the balls are men. So it's that's how it works.
Exactly. And then also the other thing that comes up is when I do bring this up and talk about it, people go, but how can a woman rape a man?
Well, through many ways. I mean, there's lots of interesting research on that.
It was, yeah, it's...
like coercion, for example, pressure.
People can do it when they just want to get out of a situation. If you're in a situation where you're being forced to do something, yeah, you can do things that you don't want to do and that aren't natural to you.
I mean,
to survive, going back to survival.
You just got to look at the statistics, because in 2014-15, where America adopted forced to penetrate as legitimate rape, the male victim statistics went from about 8 or 9% to 37% overnight. Like 1 year it was 8 or 9%, and the next year 37%, and then a really amazing feminist researcher called Lara Stempel looked into it, and she found that it's because of the definition changed, and these men are always being raped, but we just never recognize them.
It wasn't acceptable to express to come forward with it.
No.
Because it was men don't get raped.
No.
And men, well, if men do get raped, it's only by other men. It's impossible for a man to be raped by a woman.
And it isn't just men who are erased through this gendered language in the Sexual Offences Act, but also non-binary people aren't included. Members of the trans community aren't included. And women themselves aren't included. And if they're raped by another woman, it's really just a real blind spot within our legislation in the UK, and it just needs to be changed.
It's such a controversial topic.
Yeah.
I don't know why it has to be.
So I'm currently working on a project that is embargoed right now to change that, to bring it to light and to change that legislation.
Right.
So it will be revealed more to come. It's just under wraps right now.
And the same for domestic violence.
Yeah.
And specifically the Diluth model.
Yeah.
Which Erin also spoke about. And if you read the Diluth model, which is the most widely adopted framework for identifying abuse in the world, it's everywhere. And it's, again, does he do this? Does he do that? Does she feel this way about him? It even has...
It's gendered.
It's so gendered.
Gendered.
It's ideological. And this is what's sort of guiding our framework and our response to domestic violence. And this goes back to the 20 beds for men and the 3,600 for women. And this is why.
And no wonder if you have a domestic abuse case and a man reads the Diluth model, and no wonder that they wouldn't come forward, because what you're being fed is, oh, wait, I'm the, I'm not the victim.
Right.
I'm the abuser, because this is he.
Even if a man is a survivor or experiencing abuse, he calls the police, he's still the one more likely to be arrested.
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, that's often a big but very important tangent. Maybe we should bring it back to human. I would love to know, you mentioned how when you were younger, you went to the doctors and they gave you the prescription. And I totally get what you say, but if... In a hypothetical world, if you could go back in time and meet the river of... How old are you at that point? Like
19.
If this version of River had an office opposite that doctor's, and he could step out of the doctor's into the human space that offers men the judgment-free, anonymous, non-clinical spaces, what would you say to the 19-year-old version of yourself?
If the human space did exist?
Yeah, like...
Well, I've always said that I set it up in response to what I felt... I didn't have, and what I wish I had. I felt like, in a way, it was this sort of, wanted to build it as a way of a manual to living, being able to live, that I don't feel like we've had as men, and especially on the emotional intelligence, emotional education side of things. And that's how I designed the format of the space. So it's split into two main parts. It's an hour session every week, every Monday at 6:30 p.m. And the first half is for men to share anything they want to get off their chest through raised voice sharing.
Mm.
So, and I'll go into this, the importance of raised voice sharing is that no one's ever picked to share, and no one's ever picked to talk. They talk if they want to talk.
Right.
And then the second half is based on that week's theme. So whether it be empathy, fear, shame, vulnerability, relationships, death. And then we close this session to bring it back to the present as we close, just one piece of gratitude, something you're grateful for in that day.
Yeah.
So it brings it right back to the present. If someone's sharing something from their past, then we bring it back to the present, and that's how we close.
So for those who haven't been, what sort of thing are people grateful for?
So we get a range of things, but a lot of things that we do get, people do say, I'm grateful for this space that I've never had before, that I feel like I've never had before, and these other guys here being open, and me being able to share because you shared something that resonated with me. And that's the power of the space as well, is that, like, because there is never anyone being forced to talk, or it's not around the room, and you share that when you feel like something, you feel inspired to, or you feel motivated to, you could hear everything someone says, or one piece of something it says that you resonate with, that you go, yeah. or that triggers something, you're like, ah, I now want to talk. And that's the beauty of it. And I think that what is unique about the human space, and what's really important to me, was that there's a lot of talk, and when I was setting up Human, about men need to talk, men need to talk. And I think that I was going, yes, but how and where and when, and they're just not really being the way in the space to do it. But then the other side of, we're given two ears and one mouth. Yeah. Two ears, because I think listening is even more important than talking, because it informs our talking, right? Our listening. And I think in society, we listen to respond rather than listen to hear.
Right.
And I think the human, and I designed the human space so that it increased that power and that learning of listening to really hear rather than listening to respond.
Like, a lot of people listen just because they're waiting for their chance to speak, yeah. which is really quite sad. And a lot.
And I also want to say that, like, I'm not, I think, like, I think in society across the world, we still do it. Like, we interject and we want to jump in.
I mean, that's awesome.
But that's why I interject and do it, to give you the example. Yeah, but this is what, like, it's the practice in the human space of being able to increase that listening to hear rather than listening to respond. And then that increases our empathy. So it's like the basis for our empathy.
No, I will interrupt. And that's part of the healthy diet. I mean,
prime example. No, I'm joking.
A lot of people, when they listen to a person's problems, they just provide solutions rather than just listening and being like, that sounds awful, River. I'm really sorry. I'm so sorry to hear that. Or they make it about themselves. But a lot of the time it's about, have you tried this? Drink some more water. Look at your diet. Get some sleep. And it's like, I'm not looking for solutions. I just want to be heard. So to the people listening now, what advice could you give to make people a better listener and to expand your learnings of the human space wider to everyone listening?
So to say that human in the human space never give prescriptive advice.
Okay.
And that it is that giving that space for men to be able to express themselves and then really be heard. And increasing that power of listening and increasing the their emotional intelligence. And I would say that in terms of, you're asking me directly what advice I would give after saying that we don't give prescriptive advice, but this is a podcast question to me. So
right.
I would say that being aware or conscious of that, if someone's coming to you, I think naturally we think, oh, I need to give them a solution.
I need to fix this.
Right? But I have learned that people, as you've just articulated, that sometimes people do want to be given a solution, but then other times they literally just want to be heard.
Right.
So I think it's working that out. And I think also asking the person, do you just want me to be a sounding board for this? Or do you want me to listen and try and give you solutions to it? Because sometimes people, it's not clear what they want, or they're not sure what they want. And sometimes they do just want someone to listen, but sometimes they do want a perspective, another perspective, an outside perspective.
And it's sort of a bit like a chicken and egg, like by helping men or all people learn to be better listeners, we are also encouraging other men to become better talkers.
Exactly.
You can't encourage someone to talk if people are awful at listening. So they really come hand in hand. And I feel like people in the space are watching other men speak without judgment, just the ability to watch others do it first allows them to do it too. I mean, I'd love to
100%.
Hear, what sort of journey have you seen men? I mean,
100%. You know, I see men coming in who just can't speak, and they don't speak for several weeks, you know, maybe 2-3 weeks, and then they suddenly open up, and then gradually they're opening up more and more, and they may even say something that sort of, even the first time they speak, that is so powerful for other men.
Yeah.
That they could do it for these men who've been tending longer, but then so they do it for someone else. So it's this sort of domino effect. And I think the more honest that people are when they are opening up and sharing, the better it is for everyone. The more that person gets out of it, the more everyone else gets out of it. and it sets the kind of tone.
Like, you must feel so proud doing this and giving men this space that wouldn't exist. And to see men, you talked about what they're grateful for and the fact that they're grateful for what you've done. Like, how does it feel as River to be on the receiving end of such gratitude?
Well, when I said about the gratitude, they're also grateful for other things. I don't want it to seem like they all just say that they're grateful for this. You know, they talk about grateful for, you know, their relationships, their girlfriend, or their and simple things like getting the you know, the moment where you get try and get the tube and then the lift doors open as you're going through the barrier, and it's just like
that's
you know, it's like something like that. It's like something simple as well, small. So I just wanted to preface it with that. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I did this because I created Human because I felt that the current approach, well, it was obvious that something had to change and that I felt like there was a huge gap. And for me, it's just about being able to, it, you know, Human is about gender equality and reducing that gap. And being able to increase something that I feel we've been denied as men. Obviously, we've been privileged in so many ways as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that. Yeah. But I think we've been denied in terms of that emotional education. So when your question was about how does it feel for me when people say they're grateful?
Yeah.
Was that
not as River from Human, or, you know, you're the CEO of the chat, like just as a human being, as River, the man. Like, how does that feel?
Yeah, I mean, it feels brilliant. I said the other day that there was a guy called Ben who contacted us and opened up about being on the verge of taking his own life last year. He's 19. So yeah, the age I was that I wanted to set up Human or went through that. And he said, I want to put on a football match. And it, just last Saturday he did it, and he sent me over the pictures, and I was just so excited and proud and amazed by that. And it's outside of every, you know, other things that people may think, oh, you know, that are larger, or that just gave me so much joy and happiness that someone who has seen the cause resonated with the cause, not knowing me, not knowing anyone else, and wanting to create a whole their own event for it. And they had over 100 people attend this match, and he had all Human football kits made and raised money for the organization. Yeah, that's an example of where it's, you know, you kind of, it's more validation that in a way when someone goes to all that effort for something that you've pulled together that that makes sense.
No, that makes total sense. I mean, normally wait until the end to do the plug, but I feel like people listening right now will be like, I want to go to the human space. So for the people listening right now I imagine that really want to access this amazing space you've created, how do they actually do it? How do they join the Human space?
So our website, which is wearehuman.org, Human is spelled H-U-M-E-N, or you can Google Human, H-U-M-E-N. And then on social media, across all platforms, we are human.org, human.org. And there is the Human space online for anyone across the world. And then now we are coming back out of the pandemic. We are reopening our in-person Human spaces, which will eventually be across the whole of the UK. So if you check out the website for the locations that are reopening, and hopefully there is one near you. And if not, there will be soon.
So in the UK, there's various physical spaces, whereas anyone worldwide can join the online spaces.
Exactly. So when we transitioned online, we actually, it was incredible. We had people joining at 2 a.m. for them in different countries all over the world, or 6 a.m. And so Australia, India, Bali, America. So the online Human space is the same time as the physical spaces, 6:30 p.m. BST. If you're listening to this when you're in GMT, then it'll be GMT.
I'd love to know a little bit about the journey of setting up Human and any sort of resistance you may have faced, because I've certainly faced a little bit, but you must have experienced even more. Like, what were people's initial reactions when you were like, I want to create a space for men to talk or not to talk or to listen? What were people's responses like to that?
Who do you think you are? Why are you setting it up? You can't do that.
But who's saying this? Friends or
friends, and also people who I would meet along the way, along the journey, that you get introduced to or that you reach out to, and then some of those same people are the ones who then contact you, go, congratulations, it's so brilliant, well done, so proud, and yeah, it's funny, it's interesting, but I think that. I think if you have like a real, as long as like, I think it's a true authentic and genuine is the word, want and purpose to do something, you can do it and willing to put in like all the work and the resistance that you get. I think it only doesn't work when the agenda is not pure, you know?
Yeah.
When it's really for kind of your own other reasons.
I would love to know, even from a financial point of view, if you're comfortable sort of sharing a little bit about how much financial support is there, because you're not funded by the government as far as I'm aware. It's all private donors, people paying themselves. There's no support for you from the government, from the taxpayer, not a single penny. So what has that journey been like?
Well, when I started it, it was extremely hard to even just get it off the ground. And I actually put in my own money in order to. And so our funding primarily comes from generous individuals and some trusts and foundations.
Right.
But yeah, no government support.
And then this vision you talk about, can you give us a little insight into
it? Yeah, for sure. Sorry. It's focusing on human being, very much focused on action, not just awareness.
Right.
And prevention rather than crisis.
Why prevention before crisis?
Because I say how prevention is better than cure, because there is no cure once someone has taken their own life.
Mm.
Once someone is gone, they're gone.
Yeah.
And the sooner that we can help people and that we don't, and there's this big misconception around mental health that mental health means mental ill health.
Right.
Mental health means mental illness. No, mental health is on a spectrum and we're all on different places along that spectrum. Mm. We can be on the mentally healthy side or on the more mentally ill side. And so prevention and changing that narrative is part of men. You attend and look after your mental health before it's at crisis point. So it's about maintaining and improving your mental health at the human space, not just, I know a place where you can go because you've had a breakdown.
Yeah.
It's about doing it before as well.
It's a bit like you could equate it going to the gym. It's for everyone. Everyone should go to the gym or exercise.
And I mean, the human space is called the human space, the gym for your mind. So thank you for reminding me. we understand the concept of going to the gym on a regular basis to maintain our physical health. And it's the same for our mental health. It's, again, a misconception that we can just, you know, sort of once in a while do something for our mental health. But it's the same as our physical and going to the gym. We need to maintain our mental health on a regular basis to stay mentally healthy. And it is that invisible side of it. Mm. You know, when we do have physical illness it's more accepted and people know societally, like it's, you know, this is what you do when
if someone's in a wheelchair or has some crutches.
Going to hospital
you help them. Now you might help them, you know, get onto a train, or you may pick something up for them if they're struggling, but that doesn't exist in the world of mental health.
No, because it's been depicted as you're crazy for so long.
Mm.
Dangerous. That needs to change. And it's just a lack of understanding, a lack of acceptance acceptance around being able to struggle with your mental health say that you need help.
Another thing, and it's a list of things I've learned from you, River, that you've mentioned. And you mentioned earlier about someone taking their own life, whereas I used to say committed suicide. But you've taught me, among many other things, try not to say committed suicide. And maybe you could pass that lesson on to people listening as well.
Yeah, so when the term committed suicide is used, it's associated with committing a crime. And that couldn't be further from what someone is going through when they take their own life. So to associate that with a crime can be very, damaging for people struggling, damaging for the family and the loved ones close to them, who, for the person who's taken their life. So that terminology, it's better to use terms like taking their own life, die by suicide, rather than committed suicide.
And it really was committing a crime at one point. And when did that change?
So before the Suicide Act, the 1961 Suicide Act, it was a crime to commit suicide.
Wow.
Yeah. And then if someone attempted and failed, they would be prosecuted and imprisoned.
It really shows how far we've come. Just looking back, like 50 years ago, I mean, obviously.
But then that same term is still being used.
Right.
So also how much we have to go as well.
Yeah.
How far we've got to go.
And that sort of leads me to my next sort of set of questions for you. And that is sort of acknowledging the limitations of getting men to talk. A lot of the advocacy around men is men should talk, or men can cry, or boys can cry. And that is a very helpful set of ideas. But it isn't the complete solution. I have some research here from a psychologist called Amy Chandler, recently published, and she looked into middle-aged men in the UK that died by suicide. And she found, I think, 91% of them had sought help and they'd still died by suicide. And she writes a lot about this. I'm just going to read a little bit. She said, talking about problems or emotions does not change the structural, economic, or political conditions which may shape men's distress. And so how do you feel about that?
I feel that it's, I agree with what she's saying, and I don't think it's a them and us situation. That is also why I called the organization human, because we are all human beings, and these issues affect everyone. And I think it is a people issue. It's a world issue, and not a male or female problem. And it's something that we all need to do to work together.
I've heard it sort of captured quite nicely in a single sentence. And someone said, women have problems. Men are the problem. It's sort of a bit like when a woman has an issue, we look at ways in which we can change society. But when a man has an issue, sometimes the exact same issue, we say, what can men do to change themselves?
I agree with that. And I think I think it's probably because of the fact that it's been seen as men have been the privileged gender. And that is why it's seen in that way. And I don't think it's as simple as that. They get all the benefits. They're privileged. You know, they're the privileged gender. So this is why if something happens, we support women. But then if something happens, the same thing to men. You know, they've been privileged their whole time.
Did it themselves. The whole life,
They brought this on themselves.
I mean, I don't want to, I don't know if it's, I hope you don't mind me making it personal to you, River, but an outside looking in would be look at you and be like, look at this guy. He's a CEO of an amazing charity. He's successful. He's good looking. He's got hair to die for. What has he got to be sad about? And again, that's me being facetious. That's a ridiculous thing to say. But obviously, you have your own struggles with mental health. So if I were to apply that to you, how could you tell me I'm being an idiot by saying that?
It's what we don't see is what's really going on with someone. Everyone can put on what they need to present. And we're taught to present a certain version of ourselves and different versions of ourselves in different environments, in the workplace, at home, etc. And we never know what someone is going through or battling.
Right.
I think it's always remembering that, you know, that famous overused cliche quote of that everyone's fighting a battle that you know nothing about.
Right. And what battle do you think that is for men?
I think the expectations of the providing, being the breadwinner, and, you know, physically as well. I think also in terms of like body image and physicality, I think that's something that's under highlighted. It's not highlighted enough in terms of how men struggle with body image as well, and that it is more of a woman's issue when it absolutely isn't.
Oh yeah, 40% of body dysmorphia, people with body dysmorphia are men.
Are men, yeah, exactly. And there's not as much body positivity and empowerment around for men. And that's, and you probably get that a lot. Like, we get a lot of messages on our Instagram saying that I really haven't found many active Instagram accounts that focus that in this way, that focus on men. Like, most of them are geared towards women.
Right. In terms of body positivity.
Not just body positivity, because we do speak about that, but not solely, to support men's mental health.
Yeah.
I mean, statistically, more men are homeless, imprisoned, addicted.
Yeah.
I feel like there needs to be more support in that area and addressing the root causes rather than just dealing with
the aftermath, the
outcomes of it. What actually is leading to this homelessness and the addiction and imprisonment. Humanizing it rather than like what you've mentioned earlier around sort of like men are the problem, they need to change. But it's like, how are we going to know unless we look at, what is the root cause to this?
Well, it's, men have to tell us what the problem is. If a father is struggling because he's losing his child in a custody battle due to sexism, he has to tell us. And we also have to listen as a society and then make the changes that are required to ensure that he is represented.
So I think that this the piece on allowing men to talk and increasing their emotional education and emotional intelligence and giving them a space to talk then informs that.
Right.
I think it's paired. Yeah. I don't think, like, what does she, can I just read what you, she says that talking about problems or emotions does not change. I understand what she's saying, but I think if men don't know how to talk, then I don't think the structural, economic or political conditions can change. So I think it's a combination of the two.
I genuinely feel like you've nailed that. It's a symbiotic relationship of listening and talking, whereas the conversation around men seems to be about encouraging them to talk, which is essential.
But
it doesn't stop there, because it needs to be a listening and an acknowledging. Like an acknowledging and then a listening.
And then listening to hear, not listening to respond.
Exactly. Well, I feel like maybe not. Maybe there needs to be a response.
But to hear and then respond rather than just listening, not hearing and then responding.
Well, let's say there's a man that goes to the human space that's been sexually assaulted, raped. And he's talking about this is the cause of his distress. Just mean distress, to put it lightly. For him not to be recognized by the Sexual Violence Act as a survivor of rape, which it is distressing. So that's where we need to listen. And by we, I mean the politicians, policymakers, the government. They need to listen. It's not just men can talk. It's like they talk, we listen, and then hopefully
action is taken to change.
And this leads us a little bit onto a project that we're working on in the very early stages that I think is very exciting, which is called Group X.
Are we going to reveal that?
Well, we can talk about it. It's a secret organization.
Is that we? Yeah.
Well, if you're listening to it, if you listen to it now, it means we decided to put it into the podcast.
Yes.
But Group X is a campaign we want to do to target many of these issues. We are doing, and will do.
Yeah.
And what the plan is to write a political letter to as many MPs as possible that describe all of these social conditions that men experience, such as, let's just take 90% of people that die on the streets from homelessness are men. So we'll use that as an example, but we won't say men, we'll say Group X. So in that instance, we'll say Group X make up 90% of those who die on the street. Or we'll say,
I'm not sure on the exact statistics, but girls are more likely to go into university than boys. Let's say this is true.
Exclusion from school is
right.
Three times.
Right, I think. Touched that. But instead of saying boys are behind in every stage of education, we'll say group X is also behind in every stage of education and are twice as likely to be behind by the time they start primary school. And by taking away the stigmatized boy/man label, we can sort of secretly develop compassion for group X before pulling the rug.
Neutralize it, yeah.
Before pulling the rug from beneath the feet of whoever's reading it. And they'll be like, who is this group X that's behind education, dying earlier in every country in the world and whose health and safety goes unacknowledged? Who is this? And then we're like, oh, I'm afraid to say it's men and boys. That's group X. So group X, I mean, X being XY chromosome.
Yeah.
And we call ourselves the X-Men unofficially.
The X-Men.
So yeah. Tell us, what is that about? What is group X?
Well, I think, it's about, us creating this group to create the change in government and put pressure on politicians to realize how much of an issue this is and that it affects everyone, obviously directly men, but the people in their lives indirectly. So it has an impact of everyone across the world.
Yeah. And you sort of touched on it then, but it doesn't just affect men. We were offline comparing who follows human and who follows the tin men. We were looking at what the gender split is of who follows us. People seem to think that only men care about men. That's just not true. Some of the most compassionate and avid followers of mine are women. 25% of my followers are women and 26% of followers for you are women.
Yeah.
So it doesn't just affect men. And men aren't the only ones that care. There is a positive light that I think most people do care. The vast majority of people do care. They just don't know. They just aren't aware. Yeah. And that's why it's about
you
awareness.
Don't know what you don't know.
No. And people are shocked. So going back to Group X, one of the things, what about the postcards? The postcards are an exciting development.
We're going to reveal that as well.
Well, we can...
A mechanism. Basically, we want... So it's... Yeah. So the postcards are... We want you to be part of it, both of our communities and wider, to create this change, because that's how we can execute on this. So the postcards are to inundate the politicians with the information that we're communicating to them so that they cannot ignore the crisis that we're in.
The way it works is that we want to create books of maybe postcards, maybe 10. And each of the 10 postcards will have a different issue written on it. And they're all going to be prepaid and addressed to Downing Street, say. And the idea is that people buy the books of postcards. They pull out the ones that matter most to them, be it suicide, be it mental health, homelessness, drug addiction, fathers' rights. And they write a message. And
they add their own personal
twist.
Or their experience or someone they know.
Right, yeah, exactly. And then they put it into the post, no address, no payment required, and it goes to Boris Johnson. And I have this image straight out of the Harry Potter, the bit where the Dursleys are trying to stop the letters coming from Hogwarts at the very beginning, and Mr. Dursley's sort of blocking the letterbox, and then they come down the chimney. I have this exact image of Boris Johnson blithering around trying to stop all these postcards sent by our followers.
Yeah.
That's the fantasy.
Exactly.
And you can't ignore them when they're coming for your door with these amazing anecdotes written by you, with these big facts on the back.
Well, you're telling, you know, by personalizing it, you're telling your story or an element of something that you've gone through.
I think that's really exciting.
Yeah.
I think that's a way of both of us using everything we've learned through our journeys to create change, but just moving away from being an angry person with his rectangles on Instagram to actually making change. And I think we are doing that through that method, through Group X and various others I'm sure are yet to come.
Yes.
And you can follow us to see how it goes and join us. Join it. Get involved, please. And the ultimate end goal of the Group X campaign isn't just
bunch of pretty postcards flying around. What is the end goal of our Group X campaign, River?
So this hopefully would be the first of many goals. And the first one being that there is a minister for women.
Liz Truss, right?
Yeah. And I'd just like to ask you, pass it back and ask, who is the minister for men?
Well, we both know that there isn't one. There should be.
That is the end goal, the first end goal for Group X, to appoint a minister for men.
And what sort of things would they discuss? I guess they'd start by listening to this podcast.
Exactly. And everything, I mean, most of the things that we've just previously discussed in terms of that combination of not only the individual taking the action, but us putting in place the change so that it creates change on a cultural and societal level. So around homelessness, addiction, providing those spaces, providing more support, the legislation of the Sexual Offences Act, etc.
Perfect. And that really, I hope, concludes what is a positive and ambitious end to our bit of the podcast. But I do have a series of questions that were sent in by the community. We can answer these in like a quick fire way because there are a few and I want to get through as many as possible. So here's some questions from the community that I would like to put to you, River, and we can just do them, sort of rattle them off. Is there a chance that humans' range of action will extend outside of the UK?
Yes, absolutely. The vision for human was always to be global so that we provide the human space, the gym for your mind, all across the world, and that it is the global go-to gym for your mind for men to improve and maintain their mental health.
Here's a good one. How does River feel about exercise and lifting weights as a way for men to fight off the symptoms of depression and anxiety? How else do your members manage their mental health between sessions?
So, good question. Thank you for that.
Yes, yeah.
Well, we know that physical exercise is beneficial for our mental health. So the combination of the two, that's why we, as I've explained, how we understand the importance of maintaining our physical health, and it's bringing the maintenance of our mental health up to that, the equilibrium of that. And what can men do in between? Well, there is the human space online, which, yes, it runs on a Monday as well. However, we will be expanding with creating additional sessions on other days of the week.
Also, like hobbies. I love cooking. Like, yeah. One thing from lockdown, I've got into cooking, and it's so
therapeutic
and exciting, especially when you just put the recipe book aside and just hope for the best and just throw things together.
And naturally, on the physical exercise point, I've always preferred, sort of like in terms of exercise and working out, outdoor gym sort of like activities, as opposed to a traditional indoor music pumping gym. I've actually now taken up squash recently, which I feel was hard to find squash courts, because I feel it's a bit like of the 90s, your dad playing, not that my dad ever played it, but I feel like it was like a middle-aged
I actually really want to play squash too.
We should play together.
I genuinely would like to play with you.
Okay, let's play.
But I also, that inspired me to revisit my badminton roots.
Okay, yes. Okay, there's badminton as well. So we can do both. Last week when I was playing with my friend, we finished squash and then I went, do you want to play badminton? And then we were both up for it, but they were like, there's not a court available. So.
Oh, I love badminton. And it's just another middle-aged sport. I'm getting into it now. I'm almost there.
We're not middle-aged though.
I think I love the gym, but there's something good about competitive sports that I am quite competitive. And I just find it's sort of, it's exercise, but you don't realize it because you were really enjoying it. Whereas the gym's like,
why I don't like.
Can you lift it above your head? Can you run on the spot really fast? It's like, oh yeah, and I do enjoy the gym. Not knocking it, I go every week, but it's not quite as good as competitive sport, especially because you have teams, you have camaraderie. Exactly. It's a wider narrative to be part of. Cooking, yoga is good. Meditation. There's loads of things that are really helpful, I think.
Yeah,
and just talking, of course. You don't have to wait to go to the human space to talk.
No, you don't. And I think if you spoke about, you know, being able to talk and not just going to the human space to talk.
Yeah.
And if you feel like you don't have that person, I think sometimes people may be waiting for you to open up so that they feel that they can. So you could be that person to open up to then provide that for yourself by them doing the same in return. Yeah.
Great advice. Next question. To what extent are men's mental health problems caused by the media depictions of men as either clumsy and inept, such as Homer Simpson, or innately destructive, such as Thanos? And what alternative media should young men turn to for models of positive masculinity?
I think it is a huge issue and contributes a lot to the way that we are conditioned and what is passed on to us by our parents and teachers in school. And there's a woman called Dr. Caroline Heldman, and she coins the term the great setup, in which we set up boys and men to reject everything that has been feminized, not what is feminine, but what has been feminized, such as empathy, vulnerability, compassion. And that toys play a bigger part in our lives than we realize in boys and girls' lives. And the toys that boys are given and girls are given, the girls are given nurturing, soft toys, and the boys are given either toys of destruction or to build.
Yeah.
So it teaches demolition or we build. And I think, media play and depictions of men in film and TV are a huge issue around it, and advertising. And we've actually appealed to the ASA around the advertising standards of not being able to depict male stereotypes. However, there is a 14th clause which hasn't been added around being able to depict males as cold and aloof that equates to success. So we're still appealing to you, Guy.
There was actually a campaign I remember a while ago where the Advertising Standards Authority were asked to stop brands advertising dads as sort of clowns.
Well, there was that one on was it not the Volkswagen one? It was they were looking after their sons, and then they put it on a conveyor belt in a sushi bar.
There's like this dad's like struggling to open their push chairs, or dad's not dropping the food on the floor, or dad's not picking up their kids from school. It's like these, all these media depictions of dads as sort of incompetent goofballs. It's happening simultaneously to another voice that's asking dads to step up. And it's like, why don't you represent dads as the fantastic parents they are, and maybe they can step into their shoes?
Yeah, it is that. It reminds me of this thing that I say that about how men need to talk but shut up and listen.
Yeah,
and I think it's can be quite confusing.
So, next question: do you think psychotherapy is designed for men, and are we more empathetic to women? And this sort of brings about something that I sent to you in private, which was like a dog walking group for men to talk. And I don't know, I mean, this is a baseless claim, but I'm going to say it, but I generally feel that women prefer to sit and talk, whereas men like to be more active. We've just talked about how we want to play squash and how that's important for our mental health, but is psychotherapy designed more for women's needs than men?
I think the activity element is a distraction. So when something is more difficult, the element of distraction is a good tool to use. So, you know, it's said and studies shown that talking in a car can be easier to open up, because someone is driving, they're doing something else, and you're both actually not looking at each other, so it can be easier side by side rather than face to face. And then activities, there's the distraction of doing something else that takes off pressure.
That's something I've also learned in my job. So I do a lot of interviews for documentaries. And sometimes we're interviewing people, not just men, but they're clearly struggling to sit with two cameras and a bunch of random people and lights and a microphone hanging over their head, as anyone would struggle. But if you were to stand them up and get them to, you know, chop some vegetables and start cooking, suddenly they're way more comfortable talking. And it's so true. Some good points. So next question is, do you think help-seeking behavior is the issue, or do you think it is the lack of services tailored for men?
I think it's the lack of services. I think it can be a combination of the two, but I do think it's a lack of services tailored for men, because that's why I set up the Human Space. Because when I was then researching what else was out there, there was nothing that felt appealing or that didn't make me feel like a number, or that was overly, that it felt too clinical, or labeled me sort of like anger management, for example. And whilst we've spoken about anger and that being the feeling like the unacceptable emotion. I think to label myself as angry, it's, again, we spoke about what was beneath that, and it's fear. And I think I didn't want to label people. I didn't want people to feel like they had to be broken to attend something. And I think when you frame it in that way, yeah, it's not tailored to someone who will then want to seek it. It's not appealing. So I think it is about a lack of services tailored towards men. And that's why I set up Human.
Well, the human space is, it's a few different things. It's anonymous, judgment-free, but it's also non-clinical. And that's something that we haven't really touched on. So maybe why is it so important not to be clinical?
Because of the fact that we are not statistics and numbers, and we are human beings. And I think it can get lost that we are human beings. Mm. And I think that human element is so vital, that and the in-person sense, in that, you know, when before each session, when I was going for the talking therapy, I'd have to fill out a form to assess how I'm feeling out of a score. And I, at that time, I could change how I was feeling on an hourly basis or half a day basis. And I didn't feel like it was an effective way to really assess what was going on. And how I really felt.
Yeah, I mean, human beings don't really fit into spreadsheets.
Yeah, and that just made me feel more of a process rather than a human being.
Perfect.
So that's why the non-clinical element is really important, and the hierarchical, to remove any hierarchy as well.
Right, so everyone at the human space, they're on the same level. Exactly. Even if you're there, you're not the CEO, you're just another
man. No, exactly. And for example, the person who takes the session, they're not called a facilitator or the leader. We don't use any hierarchical language. We call them the spaceman. So there's no association. Or, I mean, obviously a spaceman, you've got a completely different understanding of what a spaceman is, rather than what people may think a facilitator is. They already have their idea of what that is, and I wanted to remove that, so it took away any kind of hierarchy.
That's really great. That's amazing. Next question. What are the overall effects of loneliness and the lack of affection in men?
Overall effects of loneliness?
Yeah, and this is actually something I've been reading about, like the actual physical effects of loneliness. It isn't just being sad. It's like it has a genuine physical effect on your health. Like, it increases the chance of heart attacks, strokes, like disease, early death, they're all outcomes.
Yeah, and what was the second part of the question?
And the lack of affection in men, what are the outcomes of that?
Well, that we die earlier, and that the lack of that nutrition and that that intimacy means that in terms of isolation, people who are more isolated will statistically die earlier than those who aren't isolated.
Yeah. Has River found that men prefer group therapy, activity sessions, like what men in sheds do, and other types of alternative therapy more than traditional one-on-one talk therapy?
I think it's a case by case, but I found that with a group, you can, as I've explained, you can be resonate with something that someone else shares, and then be inspired to talk yourself, and then learn by sort of that osmosis, like learn how to talk through hearing other people talk.
Right.
And then we also do encourage, you know, seeking outside help for other issues, and that might then be additional one-on-one support. So I think the value of both is important, but I think that the group creates that sense of, I feel like you're able to, especially as men, we're able to learn more from each other. And I think it's easier to be able to open up and relate to someone, rather than it coming from just your own experiences with a therapist. So you're not only helping yourself by doing it, you're helping someone else.
Yeah.
And also, I think with group, it's more powerful. I just said the word perspective. It can give you a different angle and view on things that you may not come to if it was a one-on-one. Because you don't have another voice to view it in a different way.
Yeah.
Dependent on the type of therapy you're doing.
Great answer, and a really, really good question as well. Next question is, how do you get men to come back after the first session?
Yeah, good question. To come back up, men have come back because they've found it beneficial. And of course, we encourage them to come back. There isn't a prescription or a set number of sessions you have to attend. It's not forced in that way. And it's about you attending on a regular basis because you realize the benefit of it and the positive impact it has on you, and that message that we're communicating of that we go to the gym on a regular basis to maintain our physical health, and we need to do the same for our mental health. So it is based on what the individual experience is. That's why people come back.
Great answer. I read another study that looked at Australian men that did quit therapy, and it asked them why. And the biggest reason by a long way, I think it was about 55%. And the next one down is about 27%. So it was twice as likely as the next one. And the biggest reason was they just didn't have a bond with the therapist.
Mm.
That was the biggest reason by far.
Yeah.
And that's not a problem that you have, because there is no therapist. And like the bond is a sort of communal one. And that's where what you said about a very flat hierarchical structure, there is no sort of leader, there is no boss.
No.
And I guess you avoid that problem, you sort of circumvent it.
Definitely, and that's why it's really important. And you know, people do bond with different individuals in there. It is about the group, but then you can, you know, resonate. You might then bond after with someone who's maybe inspired you to share, or someone comes up to you.
Yeah.
So you have multiple opportunities to bond.
What is next for Human?
Well, currently working on something very exciting that hasn't been done fully before. It's an annoying thing when people say that they can't say what it is, but it's, yeah.
But you can't.
But I can't.
What about in in principle, what is the next stage?
It's making certain organizations more accountable,
right,
and providing a clearer way for people to know how well they're going to be supported.
I mean, I guess going back to what we said earlier, it's it's continuing encouraging men to talk, but it's also exploring the reasons why they don't. Going back to your story as an actor, I have done a little Googling. You were in Harry Potter. And one of the things that actually was a question, not for me, but for my community, they were like, River was in Gryffindor. And the sort of the thing Gryffindor students are known for is their bravery. Do you think you're brave doing what you do?
I've never thought of it like that, but it's very kind and nice compliment. Do I think I'm brave? I didn't see it in that way, but maybe from the outside, if I was looking at someone else, maybe I would see it as brave.
I think it's brave. Of course it is. It's like you're fighting for the underdog.
Yeah. Yeah, and you do get, you do get resistance and challenged, but that's part of it, so.
But less so. People ask me all the time, they must be like, you must get so much hate, you must get DMs every day. No, not even a little bit. I'm not exaggerating when I say 1% of the messages I get are negative. 99% are really, really encouraging, really positive. And I think it's a very positive time to be doing what we do. I think it is changing. And I don't like people saying, you just get lots of abuse. Because I do not. I get support, overwhelming support.
Yeah.
And yeah, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I started Human 3.5 years ago. So I think it has got more supportive, and obviously the more you build something, but at the beginning, I would say less so. Yeah.
At the beginning, definitely. Yeah. The bits where I was just like, I really want to do this? And because of my stubbornness that got me here. I was like, you know what? I'm going to keep saying what I think is right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's end there. And thank you to everyone for listening. I think we've all learned a lot from River, and it's been a pleasure. A lot of people ask me how can they support the Tin Men, and I always say, go donate some money to Human. So I'm going to say that again. Please keep donating money, because they do need it. They really, really do. And if you want to keep this conversation going, then that's what has to happen. So you can support me by supporting them. And if there's anything else you want to say, River?
I'd just like to say thank you. I'm really glad we got to do this.
Yeah.
And everyone who's listening from Human, really recommend the Tin Men.
Thank you.
And love their work.
Thank you. And then the last thing is just next time I'll be speaking to Susie, a researcher doing some very exciting work within the area of male suicide. So that is what you can expect next. Lots more to come from myself and River and Human and everyone else. So please keep listening, please keep supporting, and let's keep going. So thank you.